you know, you can decide your future if you have your own business. You're not at the mercy of other people's decisions. Made in Hong Kong, born in New Zealand, just made it. We were the only Chinese family in the whole neighbourhood. But you know, I talk about that and people go, well, did you encounter racism? Although I'm a Kiwi, I still had this very strong influence of a different culture. You can see things that maybe other people don't see. You don't take things for granted. You don't assume anything. But I think when women are successful, they have greater opportunity to.
Welcome to Two Commas. I'm the host, Josh Comrie, and today Two Commas particularly is about exits and seven-figure exits. So we really profile and chronicle great entrepreneurs that have typically started a business and taken that business all the way through to a wonderful exit. On today's show, I'm really gratified to have the company of Marissa Fong. Marissa's a good friend, and we've known each other for nearly 20 years now, perhaps even slightly older, but I'm not going to date us any further beyond that. Marissa is quite a luminary in and around the entrepreneurship space, particularly recognised for her stint and tenure in the recruitment space, but she's gone on from that into a multitude of different sectors. And she's an inductee into the Hall of Entrepreneurship Fame, particularly around female entrepreneurship. And so really, really pleased to welcome you to the show today, Marissa. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
I always like to start these conversations with just a little bit of a backstory. So my research has dug some things up, but I want to make a bit of an open slate before we get into that. So perhaps could you introduce us to Marissa, please?
Sure. So I like to swing this out. Made in Hong Kong, born in New Zealand.
I love it.
Just made it as a Kiwi. So mum arrived 7 months pregnant or something like that. So I'm a typical migrant story, you know, parents coming to the country to give a better life for their children, have a better life, similar to that kind of thing, although my mother, probably if she'd had a choice, wouldn't necessarily have picked New Zealand, probably didn't even know where it was. But anyhow, oldest of five children, three girls in a row, then two boys, so you kind of know what happened there. In the Chinese culture, boys are very valued, so mum had to keep on going, poor thing. So anyhow, very hardworking. I think my business sensibilities came from watching my parents. Although they were poor, they were really smart, you know, and they were clever in the things that they did that leveraged the investment into property and things. So even though, my father was a cook and then he started his own restaurant. Mum always worked in the home doing piecework, which was kind of being paid by the piece back in the day. I don't know, you'll be too young to remember this, but manufacturing, seamstress work, you could get delivered a whole lot of, you know, a pile of 200 collars to sew onto T-shirts or something, and you would get paid per piece. So mum did that, and then we used to help as well, because the more pieces she did got through, the more we got paid. So that's how, but using that kind of money to then leverage into buying property, which that really helped them grow wealth. And but also from a business perspective, I mean, I worked in the restaurants, right? So as all good migrant children do, you end up working there after school, weekends. But that was my inspiration, seeing my parents grow prosperity through not just hard work but being smart with the result of that hard work, you know, investing wisely. They had some good help though, so that's something that's really stuck with me, the stories of the support they got from people around them. And I can talk a little bit about that later, but yeah, that's important, because that's part of the give back for me, is that people that helped my parents, I remember that the stories that they've told me inspire me to say, okay, well, now my turn. You know?
Actually, let's talk about that now, because it has come up through our research that it is important to you to have impact and to kind of maintain contribution to the space, yep, or spaces.
Yep.
And so I've heard the notion in leadership of being, and I really like this as a metaphor, of don't pull the ladder up behind you.
Yep.
In other words, leave it there so that others can kind of navigate that same path. But perhaps a good entree to that conversation is what kind of help and from which type of people did your parents have that positive experience?
So I can list three types. One was definitely financial. So there was a, there weren't many Asian people in my neighbourhood. I grew up in Blockhouse Bay, New Windsor, and there were really only two coloured families, us, the Chinese family, and one Māori family. And that was it. The rest were, they were migrants too, but they were usually from the UK. So there was one old gentleman who, a Chinese gentleman, who kind of adopted my parents as sort of pseudo kids or whatever, helped them with a deposit into their first home. So with an interest-free loan. My parents paid that loan back very quickly. They worked really hard to do that. And then they were able to borrow more money from him again, but this time at an interest rate, which they, you know, paid, to buy a rental property. So, again, just having that idea to do it, but also then being given the access to financial support to be able to do it. And, you know, I don't know many people who privately lend money to a young couple with really no security and hope for the best. So there's that. Then they had a lot of support around bringing their family. So they were good friends with, they were Labour MPs, Eddie Isby back in the day, who, and good lawyers, Doug Graham, who was one of their lawyers, who sort of taught them about investing and property ownership and how you can build wealth around that kind of stuff. So that's really, I think, something that they would never have found out on their own potentially. Do you know what I mean? They would have had to work out that quite a very difficult way. And the third type of help was just the neighbourhood. So the fact that women in that space, in that time, were typically in the home, but, you know, my mum couldn't cook, like, New Zealand food. She didn't know how to bake, any of that stuff. She had no support network. You know, she had no family here. So the neighbourhood woman and the network around her that she built, who supported her, taught her some basic kind of Kiwi cooking and how to make a pav and a sponge cake and that kind of stuff, you know, she really appreciated. And then when she got sick, I remember we all got really, really sick, including her. The neighbourhood woman came and helped out, which, again, you know, is just that whole support. You know, when you're on your own, she was very young, with a lot of children. And I just think, you know, you can't really go very far without help. I mean, it just makes the journey much harder. And so I really appreciate that. And I think that the way my mother talks about it and my father, then you think, well, kind of, where would they be without that? They probably would have been all right, but maybe not where they are now, which is really, they've done really well. Extraordinarily well,
Yeah, that's a great story. I hear you talking about support in business and, you know, developing business acumen and understanding how business is done here. Financial support in the form of interest-free loans, which is phenomenal. I'm not sure which era that was, but, you know, there's certain times there in the last, in the decades that I'm thinking of, which could have been quite high inflation, therefore quite high interest rates as well, potentially. So that was a real help. And then help in becoming a great Kiwi as well, learning how to cook a pav and a sponge. And so, you know, my view on New Zealand is that we are all immigrants to this country. Some happen to come here earlier than others, you know, a thousand odd years or so ago. And others of us have arrived more recently. You know, I'm from a European father and a New Zealand mother. And so at some stage, we've all had to integrate ourselves into the country. And I don't know, and I'm just curious, we still rely to a pretty good degree upon immigrants as a country, and we tend to be a bit of a you know, pre-grooming ground for Australia, rightly or wrongly, and also for, you know, second, third, fourth generation Kiwis heading over there for a stint quite often. And so do you have any visibility or view into what the support is available now today for new immigrant families to New Zealand? Is the same ethos or mentality still around, or has it abated somewhat?
I think, well, there is definitely the migrants network, and they do a lot of resettlement and helping people with, you know, even donating goods to that organisation. They get furniture and things like that to their first homes. I do believe there is that support, but, I mean, over the years, as, you know, we've struggled with deficits in government budgets and things, I know there have been some cutting of services. But I think there's also a lot of volunteer work in that space, because if you've been a migrant and you are doing okay, typically you'd want to try and make other people's paths easier. So I'm not 100% sure about how much help they get. My biggest concern at the moment is that we're not very good at bringing targeted, skilled migrants into the country. We're we're bringing the we seem to be making these promises that we can't deliver on, and that's concerning because that's not good for brand New Zealand. The fact that I don't think we're unique in this. The fact that we can't seem to, you know, and I'm from a recruitment background, it's so frustrating to say, how is it that we can't see what we need, you know, do any workforce planning, you know. We must have the stats, we must have the numbers, we must have the information, and yet we can't seem to marry up our immigration policy with actually what we need. Mm. And by the time we catch up, we're too late, you know, and it's in many things. We're over-serviced now apparently in nurses, you know, and whereas before we were like crying out for nurses and now seemingly they can't get jobs. Like, how did this happen, you know? Just does my head in. And I think, I just don't know what's going on. I don't know what's wrong.
I can relate to that frustration. I won't get stuck in this particular kind of rabbit warren because it's many, many faceted. But I've long thought that the universities, for example, must be in one of the toughest businesses because for them to produce a product, which is a graduate, it's about 6 years in the planning because it's a year of consultation, it's a year of course design, it's recruitment of the right people, design of the content, and then it's 3 years to produce the graduate. And so that's university education, but immigration can't be much different because I don't imagine many people wake up one Tuesday and go, I'm going to migrate to New Zealand, and then by Thursday they've gone. Yeah. It's probably a year or two in the planning to be able to get that to happen, and then, you know, all the other stuff that needs to go on around it, possibly even more than that. So it is an interesting challenge to try and resolve. But let's just come back to that story about your folks and the influence that it had on you. So, you know, there's clearly a couple of things that would have played out there. Hard work, the value of investing for the future, and perhaps not also being, like, you know, spendthrifts and being frivolous with their money as well. I'm guessing those are all lessons that have been passed on.
And I remember my dad said that being an entrepreneur, and I remember he was learning the word, because I think I was, must have been 12 or something like that, we were looking at how to spell it. And I remember this story, actually. It's quite interesting. I just sort of kind of remembered it recently. I remember, Dad was trying to work out how to spell entrepreneur. And he must have been filling in a form or something and asked him what he did, and he decided he was an entrepreneur. And I thought that was brilliant. And I think the thing that stuck with me was that he said, having your own business, not in these words, is really probably about self-determination. So, you know, you can decide your future if you have your own business. You're not at the mercy of other people's decisions. And I think that really stuck with me as well, particularly later on when I was in a difficult employment situation, which I wasn't happy with, and that really probably propelled me into going into my own business with my business partner. Yep.
Mm. Yeah. I love that. So I think too often people can end up feeling like a victim in a situation, and self-determination is really about confidence and conviction to make decisions that are going to influence your life in a positive way. Mm-hmm. That's kind of what I'm making that mean.
Yeah.
So for you, you had these insights, you had these lessons. I understand you chose to not go to university and rather enter the workforce.
Yes. Well, I tried to go to university a couple of times, but ended up at the bar.
Yes, okay.
So that wasn't good.
Well, it was, but not good for the study.
Not good. Yeah, so definitely very social. And I think actually when I think about it now, which we're more informed about neurodiversity, right, I just could not make the words on a textbook page make any sense to me in my brain. If someone told it to me and gave me examples, I could totally get it, no problems. But sitting there reading these tiny little words on this tiny little, on this huge book, just made no sense. I would read the same pages over and over again. And, you know, concepts that were new to me, I was like, well, I don't really get this. But if someone was to explain it, then fine, but not in a big, huge, you know, lecture theatre where they're just kind of, you know, blooming through the same stuff and you can't ask questions and you can't stop them and you can't say, what does it go back? What do you mean by that? Yeah. So anyway, I realised now actually it was just not the way I learnt. Mm. And so I couldn't apply myself, and so therefore I applied myself to the bar. But anyway.
That's a
different education.
Different type of learning, exactly.
Yeah. But I went, so I didn't go to university straight away. I did go straight into the workforce for a while and then went and tried university but a few years later on.
Yep. Got it. Okay. I've heard that there's actually 9 different forms of learning and 9 different forms of intelligence as a consequence. You know, we think about audible and visual, but there's things like kinesthetic and your body in space, and there's all these different forms. And so unfortunately, the industrial age education system that we still seem to be adhered to is one that doesn't suit many folk. I was the same as you, so I completely understand. So you started a company which went on to be a wonderful success story called Madison Recruitment. Before we jump into that, could you talk me through the founding journey? Because I understand that you weren't from a recruitment background and yet you chose to start a recruitment company. Is that correct?
No. Well, so what happened was I went to the UK and I was still really looking to try and work out what I wanted to do. So I ended up in the working for STA Travel in London. And then, unfortunately, one of my sisters was killed in a car accident. So I had to come back at 23 or so. And was at a loose end after, you know, because I obviously decided to stay back in New Zealand. And then went to some what they used to call personnel agencies. The recruitment used to be called personnel. And so I would go to these interviews and I actually thought to myself, you know, I think I'd like to do what you're doing on the other side, you know. And so I had this wonderful woman. I think her name was Elaine. I think it's Elaine Lumsden. And she had a recruitment company. She spent a whole hour with me just telling me what it was about. And again, you know, you talk about people who help you and just generously give of their information and their time. And through that, understanding that, I managed to secure my first recruitment role with a very small, tiny startup company. And we grew that very fast. But he was an accountant, but didn't understand about cash flow. So he basically ran out of cash, and then the company, after, I'm talking about quite a few years, company was very successful, moved into big offices. He spent more than he spent all the cash, you know how it is, and but couldn't work out. So, you know, it was profitable, highly profitable, and I'd grown a very successful team under with him for his business. And then one day the landlord locked us out and I had to go make all these people redundant. I didn't even see it coming. It was a very hard lesson. So then I thought, I'll seek safety and security in a big global recruitment company, which was at the time called Alfred Marks, went on to then become Adia, then became Adecco. So I worked for a global recruitment company for quite a few years, worked way up to national sales director. And but unfortunately, I was working in not a great work environment, so decided at that point to go out and start our own recruitment company with Winnis, who I'd recruited into the company a few years earlier. She was, you know, then became my peer, and she was amazing. So I said, well, why don't we go out and do it? And we thought about it, and then we did. So, and our founding philosophy was to be everything that where we had come from was not. So you know what I mean? Like, it was doing the opposite. It was kind of being like a Homer Simpson. We'll just do the opposite. And that served us well. Oh, well, you know, let's have a really great culture. Let's have some really, let's be truthful. Let's do really great things. Let's make sure that people are looked after, make candidates looked after and all this kind of thing, and do what we say we're going to do, which was, you know, as National Sales Director for a global, often things are out of your control. And so I thought, that was, yeah, we definitely wanted to have all the things that were going to deliver quality results for our clients and our candidates. But when you work for a global, I mean, I would go out and win these big contracts, but then I'd have to go out and apologise all the time because we weren't delivering on what I'd promised. And so that was a really hard lesson as well to learn. But there was also this epiphany that my equivalent in Australia told me that, because I was complaining about how we had such high attrition, turnover our staff, and so, you know, what was going on, didn't the powers that be see that clearly there was a problem in New Zealand we needed to resolve? But he said, you do know that your revenue is the rounding up of the decimal point for global revenues, don't you? That kind of put it all into perspective, really.
They don't care.
They don't care. Mm. And so I sort of thought, you know what, that was pretty much the catalyst to just pack it all in and go, you know, we need to get out of here. And so that's what happened.
Yeah.
So we started, Winnis and I started Madison.
Approximately what year did you kick the business 98. Off?
98.
Yeah. Okay, great. Yeah. So positive economic environment, a lot of money
very
coming into
so.
The business sector because of the tech boom that was kind of, you know, underway at that point in time. We had a bit of a recessionary moment around about kind of 9/11.
Yeah, shortly
after that. So I'm curious, in those early days, and I'll quote some numbers for you because this is really fascinating about New Zealand. So only 10% of businesses reach more than $1 million in revenue, and 1% of businesses reach more than $10 million of revenue.
Whew.
And so...
how many of those are women owned?
Probably, I mean, if you look at the stats across business in general, it's about 15% of businesses are women owned. And so I don't know whether there's a correlation and the same numbers apply. And as in other words, you take those numbers and multiply them by 0.15 to establish the numbers. That could be a thing that Stats NZ would be able to tell us, but I'm actually not sure. It's a great question to ask. Mm. So you obviously built a business that was substantially bigger than that, and we'll come back to those metrics in a minute. But what were some kind of key inflection points? And we had a little bit of a chat off air about this, and I'm curious to explore that if you're comfortable to do so.
Sure.
What are some of those inflection points? If you look back, you know, recession kicked about 3 years in, then the GFC was a few years after that. Mm. But obviously there was a lot of growth and a lot of momentum that got developed in the business. Mm. I understand from our research that one of the things was that you were successful in securing some government contracts
yes.
along the way. And so that can be such a force multiplier because of the volume of work that can be generated from it. But in your memory, is there kind of a couple of three kind of key moments that stand out for you, if any?
Yeah, and I was just saying earlier that I really struggle with this question because I'm such a forward-looking person. I understand now I'm one of those people that's just like a rolling ball, you know, a rolling stone. It just keeps moving forward.
Rolling stone gathers no moss.
Yeah, that one, you know. And I just have this momentum about looking into the future all the time. So when people ask me questions about, you know, reflecting on those kind of past events, and we're talking over 10 years ago, you know, you sort of think, oh, God, can I remember? One thing I do know that wasn't particularly an inflection point, but it's just a general philosophy, and I think this served me well. Having come from a global recruitment company and working at a national level meant that I carried that ethos through into the new business. I didn't know we weren't meant to go and, you know, apply for RFPs to government contracts because we were only two people with a part-time receptionist.
Right, well.
I didn't know we weren't meant to do that. So I just kept doing the stuff I used to do, you know, write big RFP proposals, go to pitches and tell them the story about how we're going to deliver on it and then go, yeah, okay, then. And then go, holy heck.
We actually won these.
We better go and get some people
yeah,
then.
Wow.
And so we'd run around and hire some people and then work out how to deliver it, kind of like building the bicycle as you're riding it, right?
Yep.
And so that was really one thing I do remember about our journey was that we never thought small. We never thought, you know, people start off saying they're a boutique business or whatever it is. We described ourselves that way because we were small in numbers, but we didn't behave that way. We thought we were a big business, so we kept on looking for big pieces of business to deliver to. So that's probably one thing. But as I said, don't normally sit down and say, what were the things that really had an impact on the business? I would say that there was a moment. I think most businesses, you talked about that 10% getting, you know, past whatever.
1 million.
1 million. I think the thing that I thought was more about headcount. Mm. And so, you know, I think most businesses can get to 5, maybe 10 people reasonably easily. And then you get to 15 and you're starting to wobble because you're getting to sort of unwieldy numbers for one or two people to try and manage one-to-one. And then then that 15 to 50 journey, I think, is the hardest, okay? So getting from 15 people to 50 people, I would say, would be the journey part of Madison. It was probably the most difficult in terms of understanding who should be managing people, leading people in our company of 10 or 15, to then lift them to that next layer. What systems and processes did we now need to reverse engineer to make sure that everything was okay? Because by that stage we actually had more than one office, so it wasn't like we were in one location where we had that line of sight into everybody doing the same things properly, right? So we then had to create these systems and processes and reporting that meant that we were sure that the quality was being delivered at the right, and everybody was using the same forms and we were using the same, you know, whatever. So that bit, I think, was the hardest, was getting to 50. Because the time you get to 50, you are then hopefully set up to then just keep scaling,
yep.
right? Because you should have the system and processes in place and the right people.
Mm.
So if you were to ask me what the hardest part of the journey was, it would be just identifying the right people to be in leadership.
Mm.
And it wasn't the highest performing people in terms of numbers, as we all know, right? You shouldn't be promoting the best salesperson to sales manager because that's not necessarily the right move. So It was really identifying the right people to take on leadership roles that we had in the business. And sometimes they didn't exist in the business, but, you know, they believed they should have because of tenure.
Yep.
And so that's also really hard as well, right? Yeah, so I think that part.
Yeah, that's really insightful. A key part of that right people thing is also having the right business partner. And you've mentioned the name Winnis.
Yes.
And I was privileged enough to meet you both quite early on that journey.
We tried to hire you.
Yeah, you did. You did. Yeah, exactly.
Unsuccessfully. You said no.
I did say no. That's right. I'm sorry. So what I observed then and every time subsequent that I saw you was a really great chemistry between the two
absolutely.
Of you. And that chemistry to me was a mix of mutual respect, a like and an admiration for each other. But I'm guessing that doesn't come easily, because in business and partnerships, what I observe, and I've seen this, I have a commentary around board structures in New Zealand that I don't think that we are that good at managing tension in board structures, and it descends quite quickly to conflict. And so people choose to stay on the side of harmony too often. Mm-hmm. And harmony, tension's where the magic is, because you're up against each other and you have some friction, and this won't be something unfamiliar to you, I'm sure. But how did you go about firstly picking each other? You worked together, you mentioned.
Yes.
Was there anything else that you did to kind of go, let's give this a bit of a go? But then probably most interestingly is, how did you make sure that relationship stayed so strong over the course of the, 18 years that you're in business together?
Mm. Well, I think Winnis was smart too, in terms of before we went off deciding to go, I had talked to her about it, but she hadn't said yes. And then we had this horrific team building trip that all the senior leaders were told to go on in the middle of nowhere in the bush. And I could understand what the vision was for the thing, but it actually wasn't that. I think it was kind of trying to meet to be this kind of, you know, glamping camping with beautiful tents and this sort of thing, and people holding trays of champagne. What it turned out to be was pup tents, pouring rain, no food, so we just decided it was pouring with rain. It was just horrific. People were just like, what the hell is this shit? In the middle of the bush, no reception for any mobile phone, anything. So Winnis and I just looked at each other. We were sitting on, I remember this distinctly, drenched like rats, sitting on a log. We both looked at each other and said, well, we might as well get pissed then. So we just got bottles, and we got so dry, we fell off the log and were rolling around on the mud, fits of laughter. And I think for her that cemented that I had a sense of humour, because having fun in dire circumstances and making the best of it was important.
Yes.
And I think actually she went, yeah, let's do it. And I think only seeing me in that light made her feel confident that we would get on.
Yes.
Okay. And that's what happened. So we just had a lot of fun. Even in dire circumstances, when things went bad, we were there, we got each other's back, right? We had each other's back. But I think the other thing was we had very similar values. So the work ethic was there. We were quite competitive with each other. If I won a contract, well, Winnis was going to go get one too. So it was quite good for the business because we were like, come on, let's go. So we were very like-minded. And having that values thing, but we did disagree on a few things, and how we always resolved it. And sometimes it could get quite heated, you know. So then what would happen is we would just take some time out, and then we would go and do a sense check with somebody else, either it was our partners or other somebody else, and then we'd come to it, and I'd say, look, you know, I don't feel that strongly about it. You obviously feel very strongly about this. I don't really care. Do it. Do what you want. Or Winnis would come back and go, oh, I've spoken to blah, 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 and he says you're right, and so, okay. And, you know, we never took things personally. It was always a very we had enough goodwill in the bank to understand that this was not, you know, going to be a make or break situation ever.
Mm-hmm.
It was just that we had some just philosophical disagreements about some things that just, yeah. But usually they were not terribly big.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, Einstein, I believe, said that if there's two people in the room and they have the same opinion, there may as well be one.
Yeah.
And so that's why I talk about that tension.
Yes.
And so managing those disagreements is such a great skill to be able to have. and I was thinking about the McKinsey will skill matrix. So high will, high skill is an ideal kind of fit to go with. Personally, I've thought about the matrix of either hiring or business partner selection as being values. So understanding that you've got aligned values and the repellent values are not too strong in any one particular segment. You've got the right degree of intelligence. So, you know, what is it that person is able to, their cognitive kind of ability and how well do they work their way through problem solving as well. And the last is the motivation. So finding someone with the right level of motivation. And not all of those things need to be super high. It's about going, what is the right thing for either this role or the type of person that I want to be in business with. So those, that's kind of the way that I think about that.
Oh, no, when it's ticked all those boxes.
Okay, cool. There we go.
And hopefully she thinks I ticked all those boxes too. But,
maybe I should get her on the show.
Yeah, you could ask her.
Yes.
But no, we definitely got on really well. We and the funny thing is though, we never really socialised on weekends. We weren't we had that, I think, the smarts to know that we were in business together.
Yes.
You know, one thing I will say, though, that we made clear to each other was that we were in business together, not with our partners.
Yes.
So some women or some people, actually not just women, people will actually bring their partners into the business discussion. Oh, well, my husband thinks, or John thinks, or, you know, Mary thinks. And no, I don't care what Mary thinks. I'm not in business with Mary.
No.
I'm in business with you. Mm. So we had a very clear agreement that we were in business with each other. The business was ours.
Yes.
We were not going to go and make it somebody else's business to be involved.
Yes.
Yep. Happy for them to go and seek, but don't bring them into it.
Yeah, great.
And so that really made a huge difference in, in our I guess our commitment to each other and the success of our business together as jointly as a unit,
yes.
Not bringing in this sort of external other relationships into it.
Let's move on and talk about the exit itself. So over a period of 15-odd years, you'd built a wonderful business. And so talk us through the things that lead up to the actual exit happening. It's questions like, were you actively seeking a sale at that stage, or did it come to you? How were the early conversations kind of navigated, that kind of thing?
So we weren't for sale. We were really getting ourselves exit ready, but not in nowhere near what we thought was time. So there was kind of a window. Maybe we sort of thought maybe the next 3 to 5 years type thing, but not in any rush. So part of the getting ready was actually we'd had an advisory board for a number of years, and so really it was thinking about us not being hands-on in the business. No one wants to buy a business where the founders are critical still to the operation of the company. So we had the senior leadership team. They you know, did a lot of the operational stuff, but we were still the, I guess, nominal, what you would call CEOs. So we decided we needed to find a CEO. And so, again, we are, it's like finding a mother for your baby, right? Like you are another foster mother or something. So we went through a process of bringing, he was actually on our advisory board. So it was Simon Bennett, and we asked him if he'd like to consider coming into the business in a role. So we appointed him COO to see how he fit first for a year on a contract and just seeing if that worked out and if we liked the cut of his jib. And also, about the values thing, right? Was he a fit? And so he'd seemed to fit with, we'd liked the way some of the decisions and conversations and his thinking while he was on the board. So we thought that would hopefully translate, and it did. And so after a year, we then gave him the CEO role, appointed him the CEO role, made an announcement in the newspaper, and he touched on the fact that we might be looking at some kind of liquidity event at some point. We didn't know what that would look like. And then we got approached from that. So we weren't looking at all. It was just one article in the newspaper, and that was enough to get somebody interested.
And AWS was the obviously successful acquirer. Was it them directly that contacted you? Was it an investment bank?
It was their investment banking brokers. So it was Cameron Partners.
Yep.
Who came to us. And the initial deal was not at all attractive.
Ah.
No.
Can you tell us about that?
No, it was all, well, they were publicly listed, right? So it was about a combo of scrip and cash.
Hmm.
So I think
scrip being shares.
Shares, yeah. So would we like 60% shares and 40% cash? And we went, no. And also, would you like this much money? No. So we kind of went. I mean, we said we'd entertain any approaches because we obviously had this window, but when they came with that, we went, oh, no, don't be silly. So so they kept coming back with kind of like variations of the theme, which we could just say they're just variations of the same theme, so right. Kind of no. And at that point, because we had this advisory board and they had really good connections to M&A people, we got somebody to represent us.
Okay.
And then he started really basically, you know, sending back our responses to and talking on our behalf, really, speaking on our behalf and giving us advice. And that's the one thing I would say is that if you speak to brokers, business brokers, it's the quality of the advisors that will get the deal done or not done. And usually, and sometimes when we talk to brokers, what undoes a deal, it's unrealistic expectations by the vendor or poor advisors.
Mm.
The quality of advisors are not experienced enough. Yeah. And so we had a very good one in, with Peter Jackson at Grant Samuels. And so he just said, look, you know, I'll help you. And we had to pay him quite a lot of money. And what was interesting about that was, I guess you would say to any business, you have to be in a situation where you don't really care. Mm. Like, you know, and what I used to say is, we've got a golden goose that's laying golden eggs. You know, we don't really need to sell it. And we're not running into the office every day ourselves. We were going in once a month to attend a board meeting. So we don't care. We're not stressed. We're not under pressure to sell.
Yeah.
And so we could keep saying no because we really kind of didn't care about the outcome. And we weren't invested in, we need to sell it. We need to sell it. I mean, I think you get into trouble, don't you, when you sort of start entering a process and then you can already start spending the money and then you're so invested in the process. So, yeah, we weren't that worried about it, you know. We had a pretty nice life. We travelled a lot, had a CEO running the business. It was pretty good. Very profitable.
Yeah.
And so they really – so Peter said, look, you know, they're not happy with the kind of numbers. There's a few metrics that they would like you to look at, this kind of thing. And we went, okay, fine, fair enough, we'll work on that. But, you know, we're not – entertain the deal at this kind of these, including shares and that kind of thing. So anyway, he said, you know, what will happen is they'll probably say no to what you want, and then they'll go away, and maybe they'll come back. I'm pretty sure they'll come back because you are accretive to their, you know, their earnings and their share price, and they will get a very good return by adding you, you know, much greater than potentially the multiple that they might pay you, right?
Yeah.
And so we went, okay, well, we'll just wait and see, and so that's what we did. And, you know, I don't know, maybe 6 months or a few months went by and then they did come back. And then suddenly the deal's all cash. And, you know, 1 year earn out, which we didn't do. Lovely yes. Simon did.
Yes.
And that was it.
Yes.
And we went, oh, you're right then.
Yes. Yeah, it's interesting. So AWF.
Yep.
Yep, I was going to say AWS. That's Amazon Web Services. Yeah, totally different company.
No, they didn't buy us, unfortunately.
No, that would have been an interesting conversation.
Yeah.
So they were known to be a blue-collar kind of tradesy sort of recruiter, and Madison was executive and executive support.
Yes.
Was the main kind of thrust of that business, as I recall. Mm. And so you represented a couple of things in my mind. I just wanted to qualify that this was correct. So a strategic acquisition because it gave them access to a different customer set with a different competency of recruitment delivery on the one hand, and on the other hand, they were trading at whatever the multiple is, and I'll come back to that in a second, and so they could buy you at presumably a lower multiple and then slide your revenue in, and then all of a sudden that has the boost.
Exactly.
Tell us more about that. It's a really interesting form of acquisition. So do you recall what they were trading at, and then what were the kind of numbers that they were talking to you about as valuing Madison?
Back then, well, I can't recall. I remember Peter was saying it's a times 10. If you know, they'd easily add us in, and it'd be a times 10 kind of accretive to their earnings per share. So I was, I think the thing for them was that they must have done the numbers themselves about establishing their own white collar business support type. And when they looked at it, firstly, talent was hard to come by. Secondly, we were national, so we already had a geographic footprint, and they were fairly, and they were as well, so we were in the same centres that they were. They had lots of more mini branches than us, but in the main centres we were also there. So there were some really good synergies from that point of view. So from their point of view, I think if you looked at it, they said, well, look, they could see that it was an easy slide in. We had a good senior leadership team because they didn't have people with that experience in their business. So, you know, there's a lot of stuff that would have been hard for them to replicate if they tried to do it themselves. So in the end, I mean, I know that Simon Hull will say they paid way too much for us, but anyway. And, you know, there's the other thing about our business. We were really innovative for the day. I mean, we introduced online timesheeting before anyone had any tech. We just created our own. We did lots of things that were quite innovative for the industry at that time. I remember we're talking about the 90s and aughties, you know. And so I think they unwittingly probably got more value than they possibly realised if they were just looking at numbers and you know, obvious things like people. But there was so much innovation in the business. And I think the other thing is that we could show ability to scale. And so things like high volume recruitment, we were really good at it. So these were these kind of little gold bits of nuggets that we knew how to do things that possibly they didn't have the expertise to do. And so just even that kind of IP would have been really valuable to them. So I think that by the time that, you know, they bought us and they paid the multiple they paid, which was at the upper range. So we and I think we would say an average kind of, or an average to slightly above average would be a 3.5 times multiple. Well, and a good one for services business is somewhere around 6 or 7 or whatever. So we were at the upper end. And, you know, I wish we were in tech because it would have been great of revenue. We could have had, you know, they do multiples of revenue, don't they, often. Not EBIT. Mm. Wish we'd done that, but we weren't a tech business, so that would have been a hard one to sell. But anyway, yeah, so we represented to them a 40-something million dollar acquisition by the time our earnout was done.
Yes.
And so, but on announcement, their share price went up.
Yeah, well.
I can't recall exactly by how much, but it went up earnings per share, price per share, like a reasonable amount.
Mm.
So already it had an impact straight away.
Yeah.
And then I recall, because our margins were much higher than theirs, our EBIT wasn't far off their EBIT, but we had something like half the revenue or less.
Yeah, wow.
Revenue.
Okay.
But you can imagine that, right?
And yeah,
collar,
yeah.
The margins are really thin.
Mm.
And so our margins, we made them much more profitable quite quickly.
Yes.
Just on adding our margin into their, our EBIT into theirs, because we were, you know, that much more profitable.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm going to dwell on this because there's some really important lessons to kind of unpack and highlight here. So you talked about the anchor point as being the EBIT multiple and services-wide, you know, 3.5, maybe 4.5 for a quality services business, and you're able to kind of get, you know, closer to double those kind of numbers.
Yeah.
And so if I reflect back to you, and I'm curious for you to listen for the gaps of things that I've missed about what got you to that stage. So there was a combination of a great group of people inside the business, and so that would manifest itself in performance and tenure of those people. Mm-hmm. You'd invested quite heavily in intellectual assets, intellectual property. So you had some really effective and thorough systems and processes. You'd built some technology itself. I'm sure that you had some good kind of processes around, you know, recruitment, retention, building of those people inside the business as well. And the last thing, and there'll be some things that I'm missing here, but the last thing, and I really like this one, is that you played really hard to get. And because you didn't have to sell.
We didn't have to sell.
You weren't in the position of going, you know, let's move this thing on and let's hustle this conversation along. And so that plays quite heavily into people's psychology. And there's a degree of this thing around kind of scarcity or not being able to get something that you want, which makes that thing more attractive.
Yep.
So those are kind of the three things that I've heard about how you went about building extreme value in your company and achieved a top quartile exit for your great business. Was there anything that I missed from that or anything else you'd like to point out?
So customers, right, revenue. So I think we had really good diversity in the services we offered, and therefore we had diversity of the customer segments. So we had good government contracts, good local central government. We had good corporates. We were really diverse. And then we offered a diversity of services. So we had executive leasing. We had a burgeoning IT recruitment. We had, a whole lot of sales and marketing. We did business support. Our big volume was around call centre recruitment and volume recruitment around data entry and anything that required volume recruitment process. So we just had this diversity of services, but what we were really good at is maintaining our margins. And one thing, though, that they did ask us to do, which was right, was we did have a concentration of some business with council. And so we had to make that less of a percentage of our revenue, which we managed to do really well. I mean, credit to the team. They went out, we were saying, well, look, we've got to get this below. I can't remember exactly what the percentage was, but we had to get it below a certain percentage so it wasn't so, the risk wasn't so concentrated. So that's, something for all business owners, right? We all know not to have our eggs in one basket. But it can happen really easily. You forget, you're dealing different departments and different divisions. You don't see it as one business and then suddenly, oh, you add them all up and crikey, that's quite a big percentage of our revenue. So that was a really good lesson for us as well. But I think mainly overall it was all the things that make – people have described it as a textbook exit. And I really wanted to delve deep into my own thinking about why was it textbook. And it's all the things you talked about. So, we had great people. The price was great. We only did 1 year earn out, which we managed and we did and we achieved. I think even in the process, we didn't fail any DD. Like, people who aren't ready for due diligence, if you're not ready for that, boy, you better get ready and you need help with that, because it's a big process and it can be very distracting. So no failure in our DD because we had to keep it under wraps because they were a publicly listed company, so there were no leaks. And then, as I say, the people were amazing. SLT was great. We had advisory board, which showed we were not afraid of governance and independent opinion. Plus, we were not operational in the company. So there's just all those really good things that add up to a good exit that, I think back on and we took for granted, but great advisors. I go back to having a great advisors. And the business itself was just we had good values. I think people talk about values and culture a lot these days, but not so much back then. And it was something that we were very proud of, and we used to win all these awards and all that kind of stuff. So you sort of think, you go back to it, can seem, I know back then, really, people thought it was waffly, and what is this about? Who cares, But I credit that with everything else. Without the people, you can't really do anything, That 15 to 50 thing was really a journey, and then even after that, you just got to make sure we went to 100, actually. And that was, if you didn't have the right people in place, we couldn't have done that.
I understand that here. You touched on DD. I'd just like to scratch that a little further, if I may. So things like, data room preparation and access to the key information around business exposure, reporting, analytics, all that sort of stuff, it is absolutely brutal. And I want to just ask a couple of questions here. So I'll re-clarify the negotiation kind of process, which sounds like it was about 6 or 8 months or so to land on a price that you were happy with. I'd imagine that you then had the letter of intent, and post that being signed, non-committal either side, DD was incepted and kicked off. So sounds like that's correct. Correct me if I'm wrong. And how long was that process, that DD process? And you mentioned that experience was tough. What was it like for you, for the business, to go through it?
So we had to assign a team. So you have to have the resources to be able to do this. So we had a financial controller that we had to bring into the tent, because she had to gather a lot of the numbers and do a lot of the reporting that was required. And then this is where the broker, you know, the M&A team at Grant Samuels was invaluable because, you know, when they've done it 100 times before, they know what to do, right? They know the questions are going to be asked. They can look at your data and tell you, before they even present it to the other side, what's going to be a problem or what's not going to be a problem or what's going to be good to highlight what's perhaps not so good. So you really can't be doing this on your own, and certainly you can't be doing it with people who don't know what they're doing. So finding people who've done this 100 times before, but what was difficult about it was just, you know, the distraction, the time and the fiddliness of the numbers. You know, you think when you've got your accounts being done for taxation and all that kind of stuff, but that's not the numbers they want. I mean, you know, the numbers they're looking for are not the numbers you're doing in your P&L and, your balance sheet and that sort of thing. But they're looking for much different, more performance metrics, you know, like things like, as I said, what percentage of revenue sit with what customers? Who are your top 10 customers? How much do they bill? How long have they been with you? You know, and you're having to dive deep for basic things like that. And then they go, well, what about your leases? Are they all up to date? Oh, what about your employment agreements? Are all your employment agreements up to date? You know, and so you think about the people you promote, you've been with you for 10 years, you know, some of them have still got the original contract sitting in the drawer, you know. You're like, oh, damn, I'm going to have to go back and update that. So things like that you just sort of don't really think about, basic stuff, you know, right down to the fiddliest detail. And I'm not an attention detail person, right? I'm a big picture thinker. So it was painful for me to have to sit there going, oh, yeah, well, what? And then luckily I didn't have to go and find it and do it, but just understanding the level of detail that's required for people to do the analysis and run the numbers. The whole process took us 2 years in terms of that, from first approach to final sign-off is, you know, money in the bank was probably about 2 years.
Yeah, and then plus 1 year for the earn-out.
Yes.
Yeah.
But the 2 years included the 6 or 8 months, the 6 months they went away, you know, because we were like, no. So, yeah, I'd say roughly 2 years the whole thing took.
Okay, that's insightful. And looking back on that entire journey now, you know, no regrets, but looking back on that entire journey now and having the exposure and experience you've had post doing that deal, now investing in a bunch of companies and I think taking a couple of those through to exit as well, what would you do differently, if anything?
Well, one thing I wonder is, and I've often wondered, is we had no competitive tension. And so I wonder whether we shouldn't have gone to the market if once we had a declared interest. Maybe we could have gone to the market and gone to Australia. We'd had, prior to AWF approaching us, we'd actually had approaches from two Australian recruitment companies, but, you know, they were small and it wasn't right. But, you know, or even bigger, you know, we could have gone elsewhere. And I sort of wonder whether maybe we could have done that. But then you just don't know. I mean, that could have just created maybe we would have got, who knows, less, because the other people would have gone on.
I've got Miffy.
You've got Miffy, and you just never know, right? It's really hard to know. So maybe that, maybe, but other than that, what else? I think actually, as I say, because people have described it as textbook, I don't know that there'd be much we would do differently.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, got it. You have a quote that my researchers have dug up. Exits don't just happen, they're built.
Yes.
And so that's that story about the IP, the people, the systems, the processes, all that sort of stuff. And so it really is a textbook case, and so I can see why people did say that that was a textbook journey into exit. Mm. So if we kind of move gears a little bit here, there's another couple of things that you've been quoted around the place as saying, and I'm curious to unpack these because there's some good experiences behind this. Being an outsider in business forces you to question the rules. So tell us more about that. I'm hoping that was your quote. It was something that we found. So
I think it's when you have a foot in both camps, right? So one is, I used to describe ourselves as chameleons. Like, we could just adapt to situations and we could see things. And also, I rate, one of my strengths is what they call social intelligence. So I can read a room and all that kind of stuff, right? So, but I think also because I'm not, although I'm a Kiwi, I still had this very strong influence of a different culture. And so I do think that you can see things that maybe other people don't see. You don't take things for granted. You don't assume anything because you've had to adjust for conditions all the time. You're always adapting for conditions because, well, when I first went to school, I don't think I spoke English very well. And so, of course, there's that as well. And as I said, we were the only Chinese family in the whole neighbourhood. I talk about that and people go, well, did you encounter racism? And I go, I'm sure I did, but if I did, I didn't notice, you know, because I didn't care. Like I remember thinking that all my teachers knew us at school, right? And everybody knew our whole family in the neighbourhood. And so I decided we were famous. I've come at it from like I'm a celebrity, not a weirdo. So it's just reframing how I saw that. I didn't even think about it being as a bad thing, right? I just thought, yay, everybody knows who we are.
Yes.
Even when we were naughty. So that was a bit of... We were like a gang of five,
right.
My brothers and sisters and I, and our neighbourhood friends.
The Fong Five.
Yeah, we used to ride around on our bikes and terrorise the neighbourhood. But everybody could identify us, right? We weren't just like it was those Chinese kids, you know. But anyway, so I guess it's just that you do come from a slightly different, I mean, even the things I used to eat for lunch and breakfast were so wholly different. People were like, what is that you're eating, you know? You kind of just go, I don't mind being different and I don't mind actually questioning if something doesn't look... Because I've had to adjust and adapt to things, so I don't mind going, is that right? You know, or is that still the right way to do it? And I think with building businesses, you've got to really be intentional about what you're doing and who you're doing it with. And if there's a lesson I've come out of reflecting on a couple of... experiences where I've had good and bad ones, and what's let me down has been when I have not spent the time to know the people. And so I now have this thing is when I look at angel investments as well, or my own thing that I'm doing, I'm like, skill, you talk about skill, will, but access. So and things like capital resources, right? So capital or resourcing, access, who has access? Like, you know, do we have the skill right levels, the people? And within that, do they have the right will, right? So you're right. I'm really now much more, not analytical is not the right word, but I assess in quite a different way now. And I just lucked in. But I think Winnis and I lucked in that we did those things intuitively. We didn't really go through an analysis, but we had the skills, we had the will, we definitely had capital, our own capital, and so we were able to do it. But I think not all people go through the exercise, they go through the exercise, but not well. You know, sometimes we are so convinced about our own rightness. We'll just tailor the story to make it fit. Oh, yeah, they'll be fine. They seem good. Yeah,
yes.
They seem good. Like, yes. Really? They seem good? Like, you know.
Is that enough?
Yeah, is that enough? Like, oh, yeah, you know, the idea seems like it's got merit. Really? You know, it's kind of like how deep do you go without trying to overanalyze? There's this fine line, right?
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
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 Warren Buffett says that make every investment decision as if it's the only one you'll ever get to make in your entire life.
Yeah.
He's a very extreme example of someone who invests hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars.
Yes.
So for most people, that's completely out of their realm of possibility anyway. Jumping back a step to another thing that you said there, it's been said that luck is when preparedness and opportunity meet.
Yes.
And so, you know, you got lucky. I don't think that was the case at all, but there was definitely probably a case of some good timing, but also having the gumption to do it and the willingness to do all of the things that are required to build a great business, which is a lot of sacrifice. I talk about sacrifice quite a lot because, you know, we live in the influencer Insta generation and we're from a different generation.
Yeah.
And we realise that there is no shortcut to hard work. There just literally isn't.
I wish there was.
Yeah, I wish there was. You know, I call it the great leveller, actually, of entrepreneurship, is that I do not know a single entrepreneur that has not, through either consistently or through phases of their life, prioritised work above almost everything else.
Yep.
And that's not necessarily healthy.
It's not.
And there's this conversation around founder health, and I go, well, if you're not prepared to do that and if you can't handle that level of intensity and focus, it's probably not for you. because this is not a support group.
No.
You know, this is about kind of tucking your ears back, focusing feverishly on something, making it probably number one priority for some of your time, if not all of your time, and then really working doggedly towards achieving that thing.
Yeah. I mean, there's reasons why lots of people don't like Elon Musk and Steve Jobs, right? But look what they've built, you know. And I mean, I'm sure they're awful people, but you know what I mean? But they've built amazing things. And so you've got to go, do we admire what they've done? I'm sure, there's sacrifice as well. In fact, it was interesting. I watched the Martha Stewart documentary last night. And she seems quite an unpleasant person as well in her day, apparently.
Yes, but she went to prison for her sins. So.
Yeah, well, that was looked really doctored. But anyway, I don't know that she should have done that. They should have sent her to prison. But anyway, it was just really interesting, though, the dogged determination and the smarts and the sacrifice that she's made. And the fact that she's a woman, but, she's back with Snoop Dogg, so they're doing it. I mean, they're having a good time. But I have to say I kind of admired her, but then I also kind of felt sorry for the journey she's had to go on and maybe the personal sacrifices that she's had to make in terms of, just a more rounded life, And I one of my things that I do regret and look back on and go, did I need to do that, was rushing back to work after my child was born and thinking, how quickly can I get back to work? So I think I got the nanny on board, had my daughter in a routine by the time she was 4 weeks old and had the nanny in at 6 weeks, and I was back at work at eight or something like that, 6 or 8 weeks, somewhere there, I was back at work. I probably was not compos mentis, but anyway, I was at work. But I just think that, did I need to do that? Could I have not? In the scheme of things, would 6 months or 3 months or 4 months really have hurt the business? But I think I had this real sense of obligation that I couldn't leave one as, she was completely fine on her own, but that we were in a partnership and that I was letting the side down. And so felt really obligated to go back.
Yes.
And so there was that regret potentially. But otherwise, I don't mind working really long hours.
Yeah.
That doesn't bum me out at all. I really, and I'm a good night owl, so I used to work till like midnight, 1 o'clock, when we were in the middle of big writing proposals and that kind of stuff. I could do it. Other people would be like fading at 10 o'clock going, I've got to go home. And I'd be like, I'm just getting in my stride, So that sort of thing didn't bother me at all, But, yeah, I think you're right. There are times you've just if we look at it, my parents were the same. They put in really intense period of hard work, and then now I can do whatever I like.
It's putting one thing before another, so that you may kind of enjoy the things down the path and the benefits of freedom. Really, ultimately, is what a great exit allows you to do. I'm sure you've probably read them and come across them, but the biographies and the work that's around about Elon and Steve Jobs, it doesn't take too much reading between the lines to understand that they're probably not terribly nice people to be around.
No.
Incredibly focused and determined and able to achieve unbelievable things in comparison to normal human beings. But I wanted to pause on that and point out for the record, then as with now, Marissa, you've always been a very kind and a very authentic and a very good person. And so there's no rub up between you and those folk. There's no similarity at all.
I don't know. You might ask some past staff members. They might disagree.
I think they'd say there's an intensity about you and a focus and a determination. And for some people that can be quite difficult to work around and work with. Especially on an ongoing basis. But I very firmly believe, and I'm saying this because I'm curious about your perspective, but I very firmly believe that one of the reasons that we are here, as an individual, Marissa, Josh, Tristan, our producer, are here, is to maximise the gifts that we have been given and to really push ourselves to see what we're capable of. And I think that's one of the blessings of humanity. It's also one of the curses, because I talk about the tyranny of drive. People say, you're lucky to be so driven. I'm like, well, do you know what it's like to have a monkey on your back flogging you constantly? It's like an angry jockey sometimes, And that's kind of the tyranny of drive. But I'm curious on your view on that kind of statement that I've just made there around, the maximising the things that you've got. Because when I think a manifestation of this is that with the exit that you had with your business, you were able to you had financial freedom. And you're a profitable business before that, and you've been a smart investor and all these sorts of things, but you haven't retired by any stretch of the imagination.
I've just 18 months, just over a year ago, we opened with a business partner a manufacturing facility for coatings, powder coating and flashings and industrial painting called Coating Lab.
Right.
But also one of my things is that I actually talking about getting to a point where you can maybe do something to help others, right? And I am being more. So, you know, you're talking about being more really and maximising opportunities. And for me, I want to do that for women. And I have this thing about women who are so capable, so competent, so amazing, and yet don't necessarily see what everybody else sees about them. And so I'm really interested in helping women think bigger for themselves and reach their full potential. Not necessarily, you know, as driven. If they're not, don't have the same aspiration, that's fine. I'm not saying you have to build a really huge business or anything. But perhaps more than they think they could do. Sometimes there's some of these self-limiting beliefs and I'm just, or skill gaps or whatever that is, right, that I want to try and eliminate and help women get to their version of success, perhaps more than they even could imagine. But painting the picture for them and saying, this is what you could do if you wanted to. Do you want to? And they're like, yes, but I don't know how, or I don't really believe I can, or whatever that is. And so that's my other venture at the moment, is I run these workshop retreats for women in business, trying to help them see how amazing they are, firstly, and then secondly, giving them the tools, working on their business to give them, to fill the gaps or to take them to that next stage. So, because I think that when I have this theory, and I know it's being very gender specific, but I think when women are successful, there's if they've reached their full potential, they have greater opportunity to impact the things that they care about because they have more resource to do it, right? And so the ripple effect is greater. You can't help anyone if you can't help yourself, right? But once you've helped yourself and you're good, then the opportunity to help the causes you believe in is so much greater. The impact is greater. So that's what I'm trying to help women do, is get to greater impact because you can, because you've reached a point where you're able to do more about the things you care about.
Mm.
And so that's what that venture is about. I love it. I'm mentoring women. So what happens is they come on this retreat, there's eight of them. Then afterwards I do a three-month, month-to-month coach with them, coaching with them to get them not to just forget they've done the retreat and go move on. And I'm just loving the sessions. I love the coachability of women. I love their openness. I love that they follow through on things, that they do what they say they're going to do. They're just so fantastic. I love working with them. Mm. Sorry. That's my other thing I'm doing. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think when you're in a situation, I do wonder why I keep doing stuff. Like, you know, why did I open the manufacturing business with this business partner? Didn't need to do that. And I was having this conversation with someone I asked to coach me, and he said, yeah, I'm the same. He said, it's a bit weird, isn't it? We don't need to do it financially, but we just keep doing stuff. What do you think that's about? And I go, I don't know. And then we went through this kind of, well, if we stop, for me, I think it's about laziness. If I stop and don't do something, then I'm not busy doing something, then, oh my God, could I be seen as being lazy? And that's conditioning, right, from child or whatever. You're not allowed to be lazy. You've got to be doing something. So maybe there's partly that.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah.
I have a theory. So I'll just quote someone else here briefly. I had Miles Valentine on the show recently.
Oh, yeah, Miles. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, Miles was great. Yeah. And he said something which will never leave me. He said, it took me a long time to not feel guilty. And that was not through the sale. But when he sold the business, he went off and he founded another company, and then he got involved in a couple of early stage startups. Yep. And he's like, you know what, I'm kind of done. He was in his 60s by then. He's like, I'm kind of done.
Yep.
And it took him a long time to not feel guilty for not applying himself into things. And so my theory of philosophy is, because I've had the good fortune to be able to have kind of a couple of, you know, semi-mini retirements, and I could have extended those timeframes out. But what I found for myself is that I'm much better, and I think the same is true of most people. If you've got the gift of intelligence and you've got some motivation, you're much better to apply yourself to something meaningful that you care about than to not do those things. And I think the colloquial expression is idle hands make devils work.
Right.
And so for me, I noticed I had some self-destructive patterns that I would get involved in if I didn't have something meaningful to do, or I'd go looking for problems to solve that weren't mine to solve or that weren't actually problems. And so I think that, you know, for a lot of us, we're better to have that thing which is, you know, gets us up in the morning, gets us excited, gets the grey matter engaged, where we're making new neural pathways and we're continuing to learn. We're in service of other people often. We're finding things, you know, good problems to solve, and it keeps us going. Like, you know, we both count Tony Falkenstein as a good friend, and I won't age Tony, but he's you know, well past the age of official retirement, and he's still going strong. And
he's
so
amazing.
Much respect for Tony and so much love for him. He's a template for me of someone of how I aspire to be at that stage of my life. And so, you know, I think that keeping going is just is such an important aspect of life.
And I think that if you can help and do something interesting and help others, it's not, you know, I mean, how much shopping can I do? I mean, I don't even play golf, you know. Like, I mean, this doesn't interest me. So I guess if I reframe it for myself, then the business activity I'm in is my kind of my hobby.
Yeah.
It's a hobby, actually. It's not work, right? It's not, I mean, yes, it's work, but it's not. It's not hard. I think that's right. And Tony is just such a role model. I look at him and I think, oh, yeah. And I think we are, because of all the advancements in biotech, right, we can expect to live to potentially 100, right?
That's my plan.
Easily.
Yeah.
And so what are we going to do from now till then?
Yeah.
I mean, as I said, there's only so much shopping I can do. You know, you can travel a lot, sure, but then what are you doing between? Like, you
that's
still
right.
need meaning and purpose, right?
100%.
And I think that's possibly why I keep going.
Yes, yeah, I completely agree and understand, and good on you. So we've talked, you know, that a question of mine is around the businesses of note that you're interested in. You've mentioned Coatings Lab.
Yeah.
So that's one. And I think if people were curious about your retreats and your experiences, they'd go to marissafong.com. Is that correct? How would they find out about that?
So I have that's called Reamped, but it's hard to find because we've done a tricky spelling with it. So, if you go to marissafong.co, I think it is, marissafong.co, you'll find it. And it's on a link tree. So it's on my LinkedIn and all
Great.
That, you'll find it. Yeah. Reamped. And sometimes, well, I was talking about this yesterday, sometimes these retreats are maybe too big an investment for people, so I'm going to look at doing these one-day mastery classes as well, because sometimes that's a bit more digestible than going off for 3 days somewhere.
Yeah, got it.
Yeah.
Last question for you is, if there was an alternate universe and you had a different career than that of being a recruiter, then a recruitment entrepreneur, and now a successful investor and advisor to other folk, if there was an alternative universe that would give you deep satisfaction as a career, what would that be?
Do you know, this is so random. I'd have either been a casting agent, because I think I would have been really good at that.
Mm-hmm.
A little bit like matchmaking, you know, for like recruitment, but in a different world. Or something in the, like a makeup artist, beauty space, doing like a makeup. If I'd known about, you know, people creating brands out of cosmetic and skincare brands, back in the day when you were a makeup artist. So Bobby Brown and all those people, I would have done that.
Mm-hmm.
I'd have loved that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Just done
I
that.
I did not know that.
Yeah, I would have loved that. I would have been so... Because I think it's transformative for women. It's still in the women's space.
Yes.
But when I worked after school, I had this pharmacy job after school, and I used to sell cosmetics to lovely ladies that would walk into it, and I was 14, didn't know anything. But I used to love putting makeup on them. And just when they would always go out feeling so good about themselves, you know? And so it's just that transformative nature of feeling good about yourself.
Yes.
So I would have done that.
Great. Thanks for sharing. Marissa, I could talk to you all day, and this is not the last time we're obviously going to see each other, but I'm really grateful for you to come and share all of these pearls of wisdom of both your business journey, your journey to success, the journey navigating your way through a very successful exit, and the kind of things that constituted that becoming such a success for you and ultimately for the acquirers as well. There's kind of a lot of life lessons that have been stored in there as well, and so I'm really grateful to have spent this time with you today. So thank you for coming on the show.
Thanks, Josh. It's been a good reflective exercise for me too.
Great.
Thank you.
Thanks, Marissa.